Welcome to the Continued Silence with me, Emma Jane Taylor, here on UK Health Radio. The Continued Silence is focused on the very uncomfortable conversation of child sexual abuse and the importance of talking openly about this subject. We want to try and normalise the conversation. Child sexual abuse is real. It affects millions of people, young and old, across the world. The work we do is very much engaging more lateral thought processes on this terrible crime, supporting survivors, protecting children, and encouraging those not wanting to listen to listen. Joining me each show is my fabulous resident panel. They are therapist Lenny Corby, activist Chris Tuck, and I say this every week, every time, Mike Broughton. He's not come back, but he is coming back. He is our resident poet, and I know that he can't wait to get back here with us. So each week, we will be joined by guests from around the world to share more insights on a very crippling conversation. And we do this because we want to share more important messages. This month, we are all very excited because we are going to be joined by David Breakspear. David is a prison reform campaigner. He's very well known, I believe, in this area. And of course, you know, to me, I've worked with David quite a few times over the years. So thank you, David, for joining us again. But before we come to David, I want to start with you, Denny, because today we are going to be really looking about, you know, the conversation of youth offenders and the reality of what this means to the conversation of child sexual abuse. Of course, David is going to expand that with us, but of course, you have great knowledge on this too. So let's start with you, Denny. Thank you for joining me today.
Oh, it's great to be here again, Eugenia. I am very excited. I'm all ears today. I'm hoping to speak less and listen more because David's the voice of that lived experience. But as you well know, I worked within the youth offending team for 10 years as a specialist education officer. And my learning from that was that it's a really tricky, delicate balance between the punitive approach and the rehabilitation and the informed intervention, safety and risk. And hope, belonging, and value. And by that, I mean, yes, of course, there's always risk that needs to be looked at in terms of the person that has been harmed. But I also truly believe that if we want things to change and if we want all individuals to feel that they have a place in society, we have to work in a very balanced way with the person who has caused the harm. And one of the greatest themes to come through in the 10 years that I worked there was that there's different reasons that young people offend and get into trouble with the police and get into the criminal justice system. But there was one major theme that went through every single young person that I worked with, and that was that they were either at risk of permanent exclusion, so multiple fixed term exclusions had happened, or they were permanent excluded. And what we know, and research bears this out, that the evidence is that when exclusion happens without intervention and without a reintegration, which looks at the need that wasn't met and that the behaviour was a form of communication, we just continue to make somebody feel very isolated and a sense of not belonging. And we're human beings and we need connection. And if we don't have it in the system that we're expected to, we'll find a way. We'll find a way of having our own sense of belonging. So I am really delighted to be here today. It feels a long time ago that I was in the youth offending team, but it's come back to me like it was yesterday. I passionately believe that education, and that's not necessarily in a formal way, but education is absolutely what gives us opportunity. And there's many ways that we can achieve that, but we have to give that opportunity. And the last thing as an opener, I've just listened to one of David's talks. I'm pleased I did. And one of the questions he asked, and I had my hand up, I was answering you, David, was how many people believe it takes a village to raise a child? And I can tell you nearly every hand in the audience went up. And I was thinking, yeah, that's what most people put their hands up and say. But basically, in my experience of my time in the youth offending team, and still now as an education specialist who works with children excluded, It takes a village to raise a child as long as they conform and fit into the framework that we want them to fit into. And for me, that's that exploration today and David's experience of what happened to him when that behaviour doesn't live up to what I believe is quite an ableist, neurotypical system that education is today.
Thank you, Danny. Wow. You know, I reflect back to myself. Instead of being expelled at school, they negotiated that I would visit a junior psychiatrist to manage my behaviour. Most around me were looking down. They were pointing fingers at me because I was the wild child. I'd often been put into isolation and felt so like the leper so many times. Of course, it wasn't nice, but at the time, everyone thought I was the cool kid. And of course, I wasn't. I was confused, going through a lot of trauma. But, you know, these are the conversations that we really are going to sort of start with today. Now, David, I'm going to bring you in. You have so many different stories and you've experienced so much over the years that you were in prison. But I want to go to something that you have shared. You've said, I'm someone who made myself stronger by dealing with consequences that weren't my fault. Can you expand on that? And welcome to the show.
Thank you, Ejane. Hello, everyone else. The consequences of, if you like, my childhood weren't my fault, because at the end of the day, I was a child, sexually abused at a young age. I was 8 when it began. A local toy shop owner who groomed local children, basically, into his flat above the shop. But I didn't know any of that back then. I didn't know the issues that any impact that that trauma was going to have on me later in life, and not that later, because I had my first arrest, 2 years later, when I was 10. So my childhood home, I was the youngest of 6, both parents. We weren't well off. I probably wanted for more than we got, but we got what we kind of wanted and what we needed. So there was no issues at home for me whatsoever. My family were great. So as an adult looking back, the only thing that I can put my finger on personally, from a personal piece of knowledge, is the trauma, is the trauma from the child abuse. That's where it all began.
And, you know, I think we're all nodding our heads here, right? Because we all recognise that. And obviously that was a question that off air we all, that Chris has also raised, you know, that you really felt that the child sexual abuse impacted your journey as a young boy and knocked you off balance. And I say that because I think, you know, that was sort of the more gentle way that I can remember just completely when I reflect back. It wasn't understanding what was going on. It clearly threw me. Because it didn't give me the childhood that, you know, so many others people were having around me. I couldn't kind of get that. Does that make sense, David?
Yeah, it does make sense. And to be honest, it's taken me ever since then, I suppose, for the last, even after prison, coming out of prison in the last few years, to actually get an identity from back then. I didn't have an identity. Again, it's all knowledge I have now. I didn't know that back then. Playing football for a local youth club, for some reason I changed my first name. I was also always accusing, this was after, kind of in my sort of 12, 13, 14, saying I was adopted. I didn't fit in. I was really, really struggling with who I was and what I was meant to be. And that was something I wasn't able to work out until very, very later in life.
And I can totally relate to that, having changed my name when I was in my 20s. I didn't know this girl. I didn't feel anything for that girl. And I needed to sort of find my own space. And I did by default change my own name because I felt that that was something that gave me and allowed me to sort of grow away from that vulnerable person who was struggling. Okay, look, Chris, I'm going to bring you into this conversation now. You know, these are, you know, already I knew this conversation was going to grow quite quickly. you know, we talked about sort of the impact of child sexual abuse on David's journey, and I'm sure many people's journey, you know, expanding that again and understanding, you know, the impact of our childhood, the identity, and so on and so forth. What are your thoughts?
So my only involvement in the prison system is the fact that my dad was convicted and put away for child sexual abuse offences. And I know from my brothers and them writing a chapter each in my book that the abuse that they suffered as children at school, they literally came out fighting. So there's either exclusion because of those suppressed emotions that you can't verbalize as a young person, or there's implosion where you harm yourself and you don't harm other people. And that's my technical therapy speak for a non-therapist. That's my understanding of it, of explosion and implosion. And some people will just do one or the other, or some people can experience both. But I can absolutely understand David and his experiences of going off the rails, if that's the right word in David, because my brother's saying they would literally scorn pick fights because they didn't want to be seen as weak than everybody else. They didn't want to be seen as a target, because all of that abuse was happening at home and they were just trying to find themselves at school. And they didn't actually get expelled or anything, but they did get in regular trouble. I went the other way. I went as quiet as a mouse, and I hid in the library most of the time throughout my childhood, the library or the toilets, so I'd keep away from everybody. And just for transparency, I'm actually married to a police officer. So a lot of people that know me know that, but I just wanted to make sure that everyone was aware of that. So I don't want anything popping up later on. But understanding as well that when I've done my own research into looking at prison populations, most have gone through a trauma, and we have to find a different way of dealing with trauma at an earlier age to stop this cycle, as you said, crisis and crime.
Really interesting. Denny, I'm going to bring you in now. Gosh, we are, what, 12 minutes into this show, and already I've got lists and lists and lists. I'm Googling things here, and I feel like David always comes on and he gives me about another 10 shows to think about. Denny.
Yeah, it's interesting, isn't it? And I think, Chris, what you were touching on there is that we have, again, we say this in every show, no matter what the topic is, that the impact of child sexual abuse will look and feel different for us all. And so for some children, and even in our adult lives, we're subconsciously playing out our inner child script and our ego state. So when we're triggered, you know, there's some people that will say that I operate from my rebellious child. So the way that I dealt with life was, I'm going to rebel, I'm going to seek attention, I'm going to get belonging in that way. And then there are other children that sit and absolutely don't break one single rule. They're hypervigilant, but they're quietly hypervigilant. And I think for educators out there, for me, that's the greatest message that I can give on a daily basis is, yes, look behind the child that's behaviour is roaring at you, absolutely, but also be mindful of the quiet, withdrawn, shy, sticking to all the rules child as well. We will all beautifully, thank goodness, these were all coping strategies that we found in order to, in our own way, survive our childhoods. And what we know is that once we get into adulthood and all of those coping strategies that no longer serve a purpose is when we tend to then look within and go, how come, you know, what's happening here? The other thing I did just want to say is also one of the other biggest correlations to young people offending and education is that 90%, and the 10 years I worked in the youth offending team, that statistic didn't really change. 90% of young offenders, both male and female, had speech and language disorders or processing difficulties that were never picked up because they had learnt to mask. So their communication and their verbal skills came across as if they were able to understand. But when we got a speech and language assessment completed, we would give young people the beginning of a story and the end of a story and ask them to fill in the middle bit. So this was the beginning, this was the end. What do you think happened in the middle? 90% could not fulfill that task. And there we are, day after day, doing actions and consequence work with them in a very neurotypical way, not getting the results, reoffending. And it was revolutionary in the last year that I was there that a full-time speech and language therapist was employed. I don't know whether David also had that experience or was aware of that, but it was really huge in our time working there.
Jenny, yeah. Can I just pick up on the point about professionals, like noticing the child that's roaring or the quiet child, and obviously anyone in between? I think it's up to professionals to be able to ask the question, what has happened to you? What's going on for you? So that the child has an in to actually say maybe what is going on for them. Because often you're just told off, aren't you? You're just told off for being naughty, or you're told off for being too quiet. Speak up, you know, you've got a voice, use it. All of that kind of language is used. And people say, oh, you know, well, that was 30 years ago, but it's not. You know, my children have been at school, and I've gone into a school and the teacher's been literally shouting at a child that's not been conforming. And there's just needs to be a different way of communicating to draw out what is going on for these young children and people, young people.
Chris, you will get no arguments from me. I spend 99.9% of my time challenging education, who I also want to say are doing a phenomenal job and are on their knees. However, the job's not being done. It's no longer fit for purpose, in my opinion. And I'm really putting my head on the chopping board with that. We absolutely know that there's far more awareness now of neurodivergent young people, and that is absolutely not being acknowledged to the degree that we need it to be acknowledged. I think there's classrooms full of 34 young people that have got time-limited pressures on a teacher. I think the education system needs a complete reform. And I think there's still some very, very good educators around who absolutely want to do exactly that, Chris. And I see it happen. And when I see it happen, we get plans in place, the child feels safe, the family are involved in the intervention, and we see some movement. Sadly, I think resources, funding, the pressure on schools to meet targets, which is, let's face it, all about statistics, not seeing young people as individuals and human beings, is having a catastrophic effect on many, many young people. So I would absolutely agree with you there, Chris.
Thanks, Danny. Thanks, Chris. David, rebelling, seeking attention, not having the words to express yourself, the speech, the language skills missing. I relate to all of that. What are your thoughts, you know, going back to, you know, 8-year-old David, who, you know, was being sexually abused and, you know, obviously maybe not really realizing, you know, the severity of it at that time and the impact it had on you. And then the life that followed, because, you know, certainly by the time you were 18, you'd been arrested 5 times. Is that right?
No, I'd been in court 5 times. I've been convicted of court 5 times. I've been arrested for who knows how many times.
Let's not count those up.
Yeah.
So, yeah, so looking at that, you know, the fact that, you know, from 8 years old to you're 18, let's take those 10 years. Do you recognise that you were rebelling, seeking attention, not having the words and the dialogue and the language skills to express yourself, and not maybe having a system around you, support system around you, who were able to recognise that you were rebelling, seeking attention and not having that dialogue?
Yeah, I mean, I do now, obviously. I'm a lot more knowledgeable and a lot more understanding of what it was that I had gone through at an early age. And like Chris mentioned, quickly getting something that I don't think and I don't believe that what happened to me excuses my behavior later on in life. But what it does do, it provides me and hopefully everyone else with reasons why that happened later on in life.
And I think, you know, we're going to take a break because we've got so much to talk about, and I will get in trouble if I don't take a break. So, look. Don't go anywhere. This is The Continued Silence with me, Emma Jane Taylor, and my panel, Denny Corby, Chris Tuck, and we are obviously speaking to David of Breakspear today. We're talking about the difficulties of child sexual abuse. We are talking about the youth offenders. We're talking about David's work as a prison reform campaigner. And we've still got loads to discuss. So please do not go anywhere. We'll be back after this.
UK Health Radio.
The station that makes you feel good.
The station that makes you feel good.
Okay, welcome back to today's show. Tags that came out of it was the no one size fits all on this conversation and how every story is different. Every survivor's journey is different. Every therapy session that that person has is different. But what we do have is an understanding of the difficulty of the trauma that the survivors may have gone through. There is an empathy. There's a different level of understanding when we come to these conversations. So, you know, obviously with the years that followed for you, David, you were in prison for an amount of years. And throughout that time, you did your own healing, reform, you became a mentor, you did, you know, a lot of things changed for you. But obviously staying with the conversation of child sexual abuse and, you know, what you then saw on the other side, is there anything that you feel that you could share on this conversation to us to help us better understand maybe things of the prison life on child sexual abuse?
Well, I mean, there's a number of things, really. It's not just obviously the abuse, because the abuse will bring with it psychological damage. It will bring with it mental health damage, or could even bring physical damage. So your trauma comes into prison with you. You don't leave your trauma at the gate and walk in a happy chap. Everything that's happened before goes into prison with you. And of course, prison is a traumatic experience by itself. So you're going in with trauma. You're going through a traumatic experience that even without the previous trauma, prison's very, very difficult to deal with. So if you start throwing in trauma to the mix and you put in neurodivergency into the mix, and even put race into the mix, someone's prison experience is going to be extremely, extremely negative. And the thing is, that's unfair. All right, they've made a mistake and they've found themselves in prison. But again, is it totally their fault that they've ended up in prison if there's been no intervention? We hear so many times about people that have suffered from sexual abuse. Well, for a start, being believed is a start. Do you know what I mean? Even in prison, it's being believed. It's such a regular story now to members of staff because it's so common that it becomes second nature to them. So it doesn't have that much of an impact on people. So, here's another one that's been sexually abused. There's another one that's got a drug addiction. But that the sexual abuse itself is, if you like, the agent provocateur of everything then negative that's going to happen in your life, including being in prison.
Chris, I know you've got your hand up there.
I'm going to be a bit of a devil's advocate here and hand up through my own ignorance over the years before I knew all of this trauma and the impact and how many prison population have been abused. I was always of the mind of they've done wrong, throw away the key. Yeah, they've done the crime, let them do the time, until obviously I knew better. However, there's still a certain part of that prison population, i.e. child offenders, that I can just not give any empathy to. I have complete empathy for those that have had a hard time after something traumatic's happened to them, and I completely get it, and I understand that we should be rehabilitating. But there's lots of victim and survivors in my social media that as soon as they know about a sexual offender, it is throw away the key, don't want to know about it. However, the bigger picture, if we don't stop the offending before it actually happens and get to grips with that and understand that, we're always going to have a very prevalent child sexual abuse and sexual exploitation problem. So I get all of that. But my deep gut, being a victim and survivor, I just cannot personally be that empathetic to those cohort of people. And there are many people like myself that feel that way. However, I do know that we do have to start looking at being more proactive in this area.
I think David will probably be agreeing with a lot of what you just said there, Chris.
I do. One thing I'll never be is a prison abolitionist, because we need prisons. Whether we should lock them up and throw away the key. But then when it comes to, and again, if, like you said, Chris, if we bring it back to early intervention, there could be so much more that we're doing that these crimes won't have been committed. And it's not just that we know it. We've known for years that trauma leads on to school exclusion, leads on to prison. Again, not everybody, but it does heighten the risk for everybody that's the path that they're going to take in the future. So the more work we can do in early intervention, the less victims we have. But in respect to the prison system itself, obviously we can't lock up everybody and throw away the key. Otherwise, we'll one day become HMP England. The gates would be at Dover and all the other docks. Do you know what I mean? They'll have a massive wall around the coast of England. Oh, sorry, and Scotland. So we need to do one thing we need to be doing is we need to be having this conversation. I will never, ever excuse a child abuser. However, I can find a reason as to why they've ended up as a child abuser. And it's those reasons that we need to start attacking. Because we will start seeing less and less victims. It's as simple as that. Traumatized people create victims.
Oh, traumatized people create victims, right? Okay, yeah. I'm with you. I hear what you're saying. Yeah, sorry, I had to think about that. I get what you're saying, and it's the victim. We need to help people come out of that traumatized state and of out course. Of that victim and mode to be able to step forward and be a stronger voice.
And if we wait until they're in prison, if we wait until they're already in prison, victims have already been created.
Yes. And, you know, just going back, actually, you were saying earlier, trauma goes into prison. So trauma faces trauma, really. And actually, then what happens in prison with the therapy, obviously, you know, I know that there is support in the prison service for anyone who needs it. But not everyone wants that support inside, do they, David?
It's not just about that. You've got to start looking at the education levels as well, because the reading levels, literacy levels in prison is 55 to 60% of people in prison have the reading level of 11-year-olds or less. So it comes back to development and speech and language development and understanding. You've got people in there that are still on IPP sentences for whatever crime, but they're doing a life sentence. And they've been unable to access the courses that it is so that they can address their behavior because of their education, because of their communication skills. There's so many different reasons.
Is there nothing there for people who are, you know, struggling with their reading and writing?
There is, but we're relying on charities. The Shannon Trust, they're a charity that were created at the back end of 1999, but it didn't really become a thing in prison until 2003. But it's obviously it was only a minimal thing in 2003. Since then, it's grown to cover virtually all prisons. But that's a scheme whereby volunteers from Shannon Trust are training people in prison who can read to teach people in prison who can't read to read or struggle to read to help them read. Fantastic scheme, but again, it's a charity. But that's the thing, see, it's you. If you're not able to communicate in the right way, you're then unable to go on to the offending behaviour courses or the right courses to be able to address the actual needs that it is that you actually need to address. in order for you to sort your life out.
Circles going round in circles, isn't it? And if you go back, if we go back sort of beginning of this, where you were talking about, you know, the 8-year-old David who was abused by the toy shop owner, who was sexually abused, who then, you know, now identifies that actually that sort of obviously impacted a lot of your younger years, a lot of the fallout of your behaviour. You weren't then given the right support, the right care, the right guidance. And, you know, you rebelled, you were looking for attention, you maybe didn't get the development with the speech language skills dialogue, you went into prison. Now, you had, you know, you had a moment a few years ago where you wanted to change your life. Now, if someone's in prison who just doesn't have that, it becomes that revolving door, doesn't it, David? Because there's no one out there to support. Desperately, these victims need support. But that's not being identified because they're not getting what they need inside because the charities haven't got the funds to support the system. And it just goes round and round in circles. And that's no life, right? That is just no life. This is such a complex conversation because you've got the victim. The victim who then shows behavior that is wrong and then they go into prison. So, you know, that child sexual abuse victim needs support, doesn't get support, goes to prison to learn a lesson, but isn't learning lessons because no one's in there able to educate that person or help them through. So they'll do their time, they come out, and then it all starts again. Now, that whole process, how do you break that? That to me sounds like a minefield of difficulties. So how do you break that, David?
Again, early intervention, begin earlier. I mean, if it's childhood trauma, it's obvious at school. Do you know, there was a really good story last year on the news. I can't remember what part of the country it was. I think it was around Manchester. It was about a teacher who's one of her students was coming into school, not getting the work done, missing out on homework and things like that. And she basically asked him, what's wrong? What's going on? He didn't have a bed to sleep in. They couldn't afford, his family couldn't afford a bed. She then started doing research into children without beds and found how much of a massive problem it was. And then she set up a charity. I can't remember the name of it, but she set up a charity that provides beds to children that don't have beds so they can get a decent night's kit before they go to school.
Dave, I'm with you. David, I'm with you on that. Part of my full-time role is I have the privilege to step over the threshold of many, many families' front doors. And I never take that for granted. It's quite an invasion, I think, sometimes. And, you know, when I take heads of year, sometimes when I need backup, because for whatever reason, you know, it doesn't feel appropriate to go by myself, I am shocked each time that I get back in a car and a teacher or a head of year or a member of the senior leadership team will go, what, people live like that? Now, the problem is education is an elitist institution. Most people who teach have had a very privileged childhood. Most, I know that's a generalised sweeping statement, but the fact is they've had enough of a protective factor to go from school to uni back into the very institution that they felt comfortable in and pretty privileged to have got through. And so for me, it's about the ethics of education. It's about, you know what, no child behaves the way that they do without there being a reason. The problem we've got is that resources were stripped, and I hate to become political, but that is the problem. Funds, resources, pressure, schools turning into academies, taking over multi-school institutions. And so for me, it's about we've got to get back to educating society that not everybody has a bed to sleep in. When the child isn't doing the homework, there's no table to eat dinner off of, let alone do somewhere where there's homework. We know the risk factors. We know the risk factors for children who are not going to do well. So early intervention is absolutely the key. What frustrates me is We know this. We've known this for quite some time, haven't we, David? So where's the barrier? The youth offending team set up their youth intervention teams, which worked with young people between the ages of 6 and 10 who were exhibiting risk factors to risk of criminal behaviour, risk of exclusion. It was a beautiful service. I worked within it. It was creative. We got alongside young people who were vulnerable. The threshold's gone through the ceiling. There's not enough funding to keep it going. And so therefore, yet again, these young people are left to fit into a system that they have no chance of fitting into. And the other thing I just wanted to comment on, it came to me as I was listening to you, David. The age for criminal responsibility is 10 in this country, yeah? And what we know about children who are being sexually abused is that it delays emotional maturation, it delays neurological pathways. So on the one hand, we've set an age, a chronological age of you should know better, you are now culpable for your actions. And yet what we know is if we can understand their trauma and their history and what's happening to them, actually, are they really chronologically 10? Are their brains really chronologically 10? And the answer to that is no. And I know that's opened up a whole another conversation, but yes. I think we have to stop looking at it that a 10-year-old across the board, because we're all the same, aren't we, at 10, no matter what's happened to us, are criminally responsible. And therefore that kind of punitive approach is looked at far more than exactly what Chris has said throughout all of this, you know, through education, through any institution, is what is happening in this child's life for this child to have exhibited behavior in this way. And are they old enough? If they are being sexually abused, there's a lot of work to be done there on how they process information, how they get in contact with the emotions they're feeling, how they communicate them. And that, for me, is true early intervention.
Okay, look, thank you there, Denny. Look, we're going to have to take another break because we are coming up to the very end of the show. So don't go anywhere. We will be back after this.
UK Health Radio.
The station that makes you feel good.
Radio.
The station that makes you feel good.
Okay, welcome back to today's show. If you've just joined, you are very late. I say that every week, but there is catch up. And you can also go to UK Health Radio and find The Silence on there. There are lots of shows now which are covering lots of topics. Please do go and listen, do share them, because they are really important conversations. Okay, we're just coming up to the end. Now, I know Chris had her hand up there, so I'm going to come to you first, Chris, and then we're going to start looking at the last few minutes. I can't believe it's nearly gone.
Okay, so I'm going to be very quick, but I just wanted to add to what Denny was saying. And when children and young people are in survival mode, literally in survival mode at school, because their needs are not being met at home, whether deliberately or because of abuse, they are literally living, as I said, in their sympathetic nervous system, yeah, their survival system. They are not at school to learn because they are all about surviving, and they will survive by hook or by crook, whether it's imploding or exploding. Yeah, so it's really important that this kind of trauma-informed practice and knowledge is operated at by everybody that work with children and young people.
Okay, thank you very much, Chris. So I was thinking there, actually, you know, listening to everything that everyone said, this is a huge conversation. You know, obviously being believed was one of the first things David sort of started talking about, early recognition, you know, the red flags, you know, and I kind of, you know, I have so much empathy for survivors of child sexual abuse. And if that's been flagged, and this is going to open a can of worms, I'm sure, if that has been flagged, David, that the person who's just been convicted is going into prison, should there be a more empathetic support and sentence because of what they have endured as a child? And I'm talking about maybe youth offenders here as well, before that system starts and that revolving doors goes round and round.
Yeah, diversion. And I don't mean diversion just away from the criminal justice system, just for first-time offenders. 9th, 10th, 11th, however many times someone's been in trouble with police or someone's been in the prison, diversion is always an option, because you can't do the work that's needed in prison. It's impossible. No.
If you've got child sex, you've got victims coming in who've been abused, they're young offenders, and they've been doing sort of, you know, petty crimes and, you know, crimes that, you know, they're going to be sentenced for. Chris as well, David is jumping on this. I strongly believe, you know, and I sort of look at myself as well, because, you know, lots of people thought I'd be in prison. I wasn't a bad person. I was just very troubled, and that was how I was showing my trauma. Now, if I'd have gone in prison, would I be here today doing this? I'd like to think I would, but the journey might have been a lot harder and longer. So when it comes to survivors of child sexual abuse, Chris, I'm going to come to you, following on from what David said there. You know, I strongly feel the support system before that sentencing, the, not just the diversion, but the intervention, and I'm sure there are lots of charities that are, to help the victim before a sentence starts and continue that support throughout.
As I said before, being a bit of a devil's advocate in this show, there is a culture of thinking, and I think through ignorance and a lack of understanding, which I've held my hand up to, is that you've done a crime and therefore, you know, you need to pay your time for that. And I think that there's many people that feel that there's not enough specialist support out there for the victims. And I know you're saying these offenders are victims, and I completely get that. But there's a culture of thinking that there isn't enough money for the victims of the people that perpetrate these crimes. Therefore, why should we be spending money on these victims who have perpetrated the crime? Can't even say the words. So I think that culture needs to be broken down. There needs to be more awareness of, actually, do you know about this bigger picture? Do you understand all of what we've shared today? Because I think that will be genuinely a way of changing people's thinking, their awareness, their understanding, and for us to actually change the way that we do deal with young offenders and those that are repeat offenders.
Yeah, exactly. It really is about intervening until people get caught up in that criminal justice system. If we can intervene before people, prevention is better than cure, and that's where we need to go. I'm not expecting all teachers to become experts in every issue on life. However, they do need to be aware of trauma, and they need to be aware of changes in behaviour. They need to be able to spot it. Safeguarding. it's as simple as that.
Safeguarding is so important. So important.
Exactly.
Recognizing that red flag. And if it isn't a red flag for child sexual abuse, maybe it is for something else that should be, you know, considered and supported as well. Look, I'm sorry to start cutting across now, but we really do need to move on, because I do get told off when we go over. And Denny, gosh, summary. Wow, where are you going to start with that? Good luck.
Yes, thank you. I have to say, my head is spinning. I think the first place would be sensible to start is right at the beginning, where we said it is about early intervention. We know what the risk factors are that are. We see the behaviours, and that predominantly happens in school. So asking the question around, what's the need that isn't being met here? And how can we then meet that need? And the bit that I often think is missing is, if we're going to do any intervention, do not assume the level of literacy and ability to process that this individual has in front of you. We absolutely have to get away from old traditional interventions that are always about talking. They're always about a certain way of processing. And we have many young people that are being excluded because they're not holding eye contact in a school. They're not sitting still. I mean, we have to get rid of this elitist framework that we're working within. I think the other thing, and it goes to what Chris was just saying, is that I 100% wholeheartedly understand what Chris was saying. If we do not rehabilitate the perpetrators, we will have more victims. And so for me, it's around, and again, I heard you say it, David, in your talk, the reality is most prisoners will leave prison. And so if we don't focus on rehabilitation and ensuring that those people come out of prison able to fit back into a society in a way where they are going to have hope and feel a sense of belonging, we're far more likely to break that pattern of offending. I have to say, that's all I'm saying, EJ. My head is buzzing. I'm frustrated, I think, a little bit after this one, because I feel like, with all respect to us all here, we haven't uncovered anything new that we haven't known for a long time. So I'm finding my head going, so how come we're still not able to
affect... So we need a part two. We need a part two. Part two with David. Wow, look, I can't thank you, David, enough. I think, you know, every time I speak to you, we do have these conversations. For me, we have stepped forward again on something else, a few other conversations around this. And I think, you know, going trauma, for me, really sort of like looking at that trauma goes into trauma situation is a really important tag for me to take away from that. And that's something we need to break. Look, well, look. Thank you so much, Denny. Thank you, Chris. Thank you also, David. And for trying to normalise these difficult conversations, it's not easy. But the more we engage, the more normal they do become. So, look, I'd like to signpost you to my panel. Denny is at Denny Counselling on Twitter. You can find Chris. I'm going to sign you to Chris's charity today. She's got Survivors of Abuse, and that is at SOB_org. Go and have check her out there. Go and see what she's doing over there, because she's doing some really great work. SOB_org. And then David Breakspear can be found on LinkedIn. And of course, you can find me, EJ Taylor UK, on Twitter. Thank you to everyone behind the scenes. Thank you to Johan, UK Health Radio, to Christine, and everyone else who's working hard to make this show happen. I know how much work goes into it. So thank you, all of you. I'll see you next time. Thank you.